any sensational news about Germany pushing for a single federated Europe. I think maybe you heard me talking about it, but I doubt if you heard it on nightly news. Our news has been absolutely without a single mention of it, and yet it's some of the biggest news in Britain and in Europe, and every one of the major British weeklies and dailies have had headlines about it for the better part of 10 days. I want to give you just a little bit of it. This is from the Daily Telegraph in the UK, quote, Germany prepares to push for single European state. Germany is to push for significant further transfers of sovereignty to Brussels, which is the current capital of the EU, in order to turn the European Union into a single political state, Joschka Fischer, the German foreign minister, said yesterday. Turning the EU into an entity under international law with a common constitution was his personal goal. In an interview in the Frankfurter Rundschau newspaper, he said, it is the decisive task of our time. I told you about a little bit of this last week. I gave you the top of the iceberg. I want to give you a little more today, but to ask a question in advance, and we're going to go into it in some detail. When you consider all of Europe at the vastly disparate economies, languages, religion, culture, tradition, and history of nations such as Germany and France, Germany and Italy, Italy and Greece, Greece and perhaps Belgium, France and Holland, Holland and Italy. Vast differences, but there is a similarity. There is a thread throughout all of those European countries where there is commonality. And we're going to see in a few minutes that the biblical prophecy show that there is something that is called a gooey substance, that instead of being a true glue that is going to hold together 10 nations for any indeterminate period of time, there is going to be something called miry clay mixed with iron. But iron and clay are not mixed together. And a prophecy that says there is going to be 10 nations, there will be 10 nations who will be unified together only for a short period of time. And we'll be discussing exactly what will be the unifying agent which will bring that about. When Mr. Fischer, who is the German foreign minister, was asked, are you going to need or want a single European army? Here was his answer. If it is going to turn into a full union, then one day foreign and defense policy will also have to become community tasks. You hear that again? Foreign policy, defense policy will have to become community tasks. In other words, the answer is yes, there will be a united European army. He acknowledged this, I just related to, that Europeans would never become a homogeneous nation state because of differences such as peculiarities in language, history, prejudices, passions, and old animosities. But the Franco-German cooperation is without precedent, and they have any number of areas of cooperation that does not include Britain. Mr. Fischer's comments were seen by conservative politicians in Britain as confirming their fears that the single currency to be launched on January 1st, only a matter of weeks away now, will eventually lead to a federal Europe. They're also likely to fuel the controversy over the new left-wing agenda for closer cooperation in Europe signed by Gordon Brown, the Chancellor. He's called the Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is the same thing as the Minister of Finance, at a meeting of 11 socialist finance ministers last weekend. But then the very next day on the internet, and when I have now subscribed to this and other publications, it said this, and I quote, Germans ambush Brown, that is the equivalent of the British finance minister, with call to end tax veto. The British have had a tax veto. The Germans, the Italians, and all of the Europeans have been trying to get together into a commonality of taxation, especially with VAT taxes, value-added taxes, and having things like, for example, children's clothing and so on taxed to a certain percentage throughout Europe. England is very upset over that because it would really be a devastating blow to the English or British economy. During Margaret Thatcher's regime, she worked out painstakingly with the EU a definite windfall in the form of a rebate by the EU annually It so far has meant a nest egg of £22 billion to the British government to offset EU farmer subsidies. Now the Germans are attacking that. They want to take that away from England. Now I look at all these problems between the Germans and the British. Let me give you a couple of more of these, and it will remind some of you old-timers who heard me back in Big Sandy in the 60s talk about a united Europe and say that eventually the United States of Europe that will threaten Britain and the United States will not include Britain at all, that Britain will not be a part of the beast power, but that Ireland might be. Said it over and over and over again. Now, no matter what the reasons having to do with taxation and all of that, there are a lot of problems between England right now and Germany. Headlines are bad news as agenda is wrenched from Blair's control, says the Euronet Electronic Telegraph. Tony Blair is the current prime minister. Headlines referring to the major weekly and daily newspapers in Britain. Bad news as the agenda is wrenched from Blair's control. Quote, Germans ambush Brown with call to end tax veto. As it was with John Major, the former prime minister, so it is with Tony Blair. The political momentum towards integration in Europe has confounded the best attempts to appear cooperative. For nearly 2 weeks, several newspapers have been warning about the Franco-German drive for greater economic integration. 10 days ago, the Daily Mail reported remarks by Oscar Lafontaine. Remember that name because he's called Red Oscar. He is the German finance minister, and he has made a lot of statements which have the British boiling mad. The British newspapers have said some very unkind things about him. The Financial Times said, and I quote, Germany has set a collision course with the UK on tax. The Daily Mail said, and I quote, remarks by Oscar Lafontaine pose a German threat to our taxes. The Daily Telegraph said Gordon Brown had signed a deal committing Britain to a center-left agenda for deeper European integration. Then the Daily Mail followed up with a story about euro job losses, and a headline predicted the march of the euro tax man and said VAT, value-added tax, was being targeted. The Sun warned that harmonizing VAT would mean taxing children's clothes in Britain and described Herr Lafontaine as Europe's most dangerous man. Not one word in the American press. Not one word on CBS, ABC, or NBC, or CNN. Not a word. And these are the major national daily newspapers in Britain that are publishing this kind of thing every single day. But a united Europe is so what? Ho-hum. Who cares? Isn't it what we've wanted all along? And you know, strangely, that is exactly the attitude in the White House and indeed in the Pentagon. When Senator Sasser went to the Middle East quite some time ago and told us only a month before the Arabs imposed the OPEC oil embargo that the Arabs would never use oil as a political weapon, that same gentleman was talking about how the Germans have been able to dwell underneath the American nuclear umbrella and was talking about Europe pulling its fair share. American politicians for years stung because of the incredible amount of money being poured into our defense budget, and because of the money poured into all such things as the American Navy, for example, are an awful lot of moves on the part of the Clinton administration to pare back the Navy and to cut back on shipbuilding and to do away with these carrier task forces and so on. And they want Japan to begin to pull its fair share because they say Japan has been able in all of these post-World War II years to dwell under the American nuclear umbrella, so that Japan doesn't have to spend very much money on defense. Well, Japan only spends 2% of GNP on defense. But that 2% of GNP in Japan's economy, even though it's currently in trouble, was more than France and the Benelux countries and all of Scandinavia put together. That's the whole point. And so our own politicians for years have been continually saying they want our former vanquished enemies of World War II to build up their military forces and to pull their fair share of the load of policing the world under, of course, the aegis of Kofi Annan, the United Nations, and, of course, under the aegis of NATO. All very cooperative, all very homogeneous, all very blasé, plain vanilla, bland, no problem, no threat to anybody. Well, all those headlines notwithstanding, the American press has not said one word about it. This is a press release that I got off the internet from a speech by Gerhard Schroeder, who is the new chancellor of Germany. And as I said before, and this gives you a little bit of an insight into what we want to talk about, he addressed a very large group of the annual reception for the diplomatic corps at the Palais Schomburg in Bonn. And he was talking about the moving now finally of the German government over to Berlin. The huge big Reichschancellor ship, or the building, whatever it's called, chancellery, the Reichschancellery, is now being completed. And in the next months, the German government, the last vestiges of it, will move back to Berlin and no more be in Bonn. When he addressed this very distinguished group of people, and this has to do with the news media from all over Europe, the UK and elsewhere, there was present someone wearing scarlet. He was addressed as Nuncio. That means the papal nuncio. That means the direct personal representative of the Pope from the Vatican. And when a chancellor of a powerful major nation of the world addresses him first, that means this man occupies a position of some import or authority. Here's what he said. Nuncio, excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to welcome the diplomatic corps to the traditional annual reception of the Palais Schomburg. For you, as well as for me, this is a good opportunity to meet and make first contact. In this company, too, I would emphasize again, a government under my leadership will make no change in the fundamentals of Germany's foreign and security policy or its policy on Europe. He said, no nation on its own can meet worldwide challenges ahead. Only by acting together can long-term success be assured. A call, clearly, for unity. He said a little later, Germany will next year be the G7 G8 chair. That is, Germany now assumes the presidency of the EU. It's a rotating presidency. It has been in the hands last year of Britain. A number of our partners, the current British chair, as well as the USA and France, have put forward proposals for reforming the international financial system. That's because of the Asian crisis and because of bailouts for certain sick countries. We want to build on these proposals and intend to make this a central focus of the World Economic Summit to be held in Cologne next year. By the way, the Bundesbank just bought out one of the largest American banks. The German Central Bank just bought out one of the largest banks in the United States. On 1 January, he said, Germany will, however, be assuming in particular the presidency of the European Union. We will use the German presidency to push ahead on European integration. To further develop and strengthen, the European Union is and will remain the defining challenge for our generation. For many, many years, I said before live audiences and over radio and television that there would either come a rewriting or a reinterpretation of both the Japanese and German constitutions that were crafted in post-World War II periods of time that precluded the use of any of their armed forces for anything save defense, that limited the size of the armed forces that they could create in those countries. To this day, of course, in the American acronym, the Japanese Navy and the Japanese Army and Marines and Air Force are called the SDF, Self-Defense Forces. Few people know that they have super sophisticated Forrestal type class and even more, the Aegis type, missile type cruisers. Really, they are called destroyers, but they're very much larger than destroyers. And they have an awful lot of them in Japan. Or that the Japanese have a super sophisticated double supersonic fighter aircraft that is not called the Zero, but the One, which is actually superior to our F-15 Strike Eagle. But few know very much about the military in Japan, so far as that's concerned. Very few know, too, that even though it was tokenism, that Germany supplied some minesweepers and token troops in the battle in the Gulf War. And very few people in America know that there are German members of the German army on the site in Kosovo and in Bosnia. Now, here's what he said. That is Schroeder. The crises in the former Yugoslavia, most recently in Kosovo, have dramatically highlighted the limits of the EU's ability to act where the common foreign and security policy is concerned. Now, remember that Clinton was threatening, the United States and Britain were threatening, and they were talking about how they're going to have to stop all of this nonsense in Kosovo. and the KLA and so on is going to have to pull back its horns. Maybe the two of them can get together, and even though 90% of the ethnic Albanians are crying for separatism and so on, maybe there can be some way to work it out. And they want to get Slobodan Milosevic out of the thing, and even maybe tried eventually as a war criminal if they can. But they seem to be helpless to do anything except a little bit of saber rattling, and that was on our news a great deal. But he said the instruments and mechanisms provided in the Treaty of Amsterdam, which have to do with EU cooperative military intervention in regional crises, need to be used. Our goal must be more foreign policy competences for the Union, as well as more decisions taken by majority vote. Another little point. Back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, I said time and again, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Greece, Italy, and so on will be a part eventually of a United States of Europe, because these are the nations which were always a part of the Holy Roman Empire. This as a part of that speech made by Gerhard Schroeder just the other day, quote, the accession of Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary to the alliance next year is an historic step that will make Europe more secure and more stable. How could I have known in 1958, in 1963, 1967, 1969, 1972, 1975, long before the Berlin Wall came down and the Soviet Union backed out of Europe and the Warsaw Pact came apart, that those nations in Eastern Europe would be a part of a coming United States of Europe? Well, I knew that because of Bible prophecy. I knew that because throughout all of the gradual Cold War years of the development of American and British hegemony through NATO, ever increasingly in Western Europe, and from the economic picture and from the history of the entire area, but especially from biblical prophecy and from the bizarre repetition of the creation of a militarized Holy Roman Empire in the same old area where it was mostly Germanic in the time of Otto the Great and the Habsburgs to Bismarck. And of course, even though Napoleon was a Corsican, he was also the head of the Holy Roman Empire during the revival under his empire, when he held sway over all of Europe and was about to attack England with something like 40,000 flat-bottom boats and was not able to do so. Very historic statements. The accession of Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary to the alliance next year is an historic step that will make Europe more secure and more stable. The government, meaning the German government, is conscious of its special historic responsibility toward Poland. It will live up to it by seeking ever closer bilateral ties, as well as strengthening the ongoing partnership between Germany, France, and Poland. Interesting developments in world news, aren't they? You may think this has nothing whatsoever to do with an ancient prophecy found in the second chapter of the book of Daniel, but I want to turn there right quickly. This is the interpretation by Daniel of a dream that King Nebuchadnezzar had. And all of you are very familiar with it. You ought to read what some of the Bible commentaries say about it, of course, and some of the claims of such as the Roman Catholic Church and even, in fact, the Anglican Church about the meaning of that prophecy. Because they believe it had to do with the Christianization of the old pagan Roman Empire and the creation of the Holy Roman Empire. They think it had to do with the time of Charlemagne, from that time thereafter, when the popes always crowned the kings of Europe. And some people will actually look you in the eye and tell you that the kingdom of God was established back then, and gradually, as Christianity has grown, is eventually going to be established on this earth. It had been really assumed by many people that during the days of Pax Romana, or the imposition of peace through the entire known world of Europe by the Roman Empire, that the Christianization, that is putting a papal crown atop the kings of Europe, was actually the establishment of the kingdom of God on the earth. I won't read the image and what he saw, but read the interpretation beginning in verse 36 of Daniel 2. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and fowls of the heaven, is he given into your hand, and he has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. Therefore, king and kingdom are synonymous. Now, the vision that he saw, you're familiar with. It's listed in verse 32, 3, and 4 of this chapter, and we're coming to another description of it here. After you shall arise another kingdom inferior to you. Interesting, too, because most people think the opposite is true. They think that ancient Babylon would have been very inferior, almost savage, that then there would have been an advance in Persian civilization, in art and literature and science and so on. Then there would have been a much greater advance in Greco-Macedonian times under Alexander, and later on Laomedon in Syria, Ptolemy Soter in Egypt, and so on. And then they think it would have been a much greater advance by the time Rome ruled and held sway. The interpretation of this vision shows that the exact opposite was true. I have seen whole huge segments of the Ishtar Gate of ancient Babylon in the Berlin Museum. And there they are with the baked enamel with the gorgeous colors still there. And when you look into Halley's Bible Handbook and read about ancient Babylon, and one of the seven wonders of the world were the Hanging Gardens in Babylon, and the size of that wall, where three chariots could ride abreast over that entire wall, and in the corners it was big enough for them to turn around on a full run. Then there was an interior wall inside of that, and that the exterior wall was more than 100 feet high. And you read about how great Babylon became, and the fact that it was served by a river which flowed right completely underneath the river gate and through the city, so they had, they thought, a perennial supply of water. Of course, that's exactly how Cyrus and Darius, the Medo-Persian Empire, caused their fall, which was to work and work and work way upstream and eventually divert the river and walk in on the night of Belshazzar's drunken feast, dry shod, and surprise the city and overwhelm it. But that's for another subject, and that has to do with history, not prophecy. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. That was the Persian Empire. Another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth, the known earth, and a lot of people don't know that Alexander the Great conquered all the way from what he called the Gates of Hercules, which would be Algeciras, which is right there where the Rock of Gibraltar is on the peninsula across from Africa in Spain. The Iberian, by the way, Iberian Peninsula, if that strikes a note in your mind. Hebrew, Iber, Iberian, anyway. But all the way from there to India, and of course died at age 31, I think, sobbing because it was no more of the world to conquer. And then, of course, along came Rome. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these shall it break in pieces and bruise. And again, another little bit of insight. Gold is extremely precious. Silver is precious, but less so by far. Brass is a very valuable alloy, but nowhere near as precious as gold, but much harder. So each metal successively grows harder and less malleable, less flexible, and also of lower value, cheaper. But it's also more brittle and therefore more easily broken. So there's some insight in that as well. And whereas, as you saw, the feet and the toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. But there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as you saw the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly weak. The word broken is an error. I have a margin, and it says brittle or weak. Now, anyone dealing in metallurgy who was going to form anything from backyard lawn furniture to the pedestal on a microphone would know that if you are going to pour molten iron into a mold and you've got clay in there, that the iron is going to cook the clay, and the clay is going to end up with all kinds of pockets in the iron, and it is a very, very bad mixture. You're going to have a very poor product that will break very easily. And that is exactly what is intended here. Whereas you saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And in the days of these kings, which kings? The kings that are represented by the toes. We saw the proof of that last week. We'll rehearse it again briefly in a moment. In Revelation 17, in the days of these kings, not the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar, not the Persian Empire, not Greco-Macedonia, not ancient Rome, but the last 10 toes, shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. The symbolic rock that he saw that was cut out without hands, that smote the image, did not smite the image on the head, or the chest, or the belly and thighs, or even the feet, but on the toes. And it was then destroyed, and the entire image toppled down and became like the dust of the summer threshing floor and was carried away by the wind. But the stone seemed to shimmer and to grow like a gigantic Mount Everest in his mind in the vision that he saw, and become a mountain that filled the entirety of the earth. And that is the picture of the kingdom of God. Now turn to Revelation, the 17th chapter again. And this time we'll peruse that a little bit and then go to the 18th chapter as well. As I said last time, if you only had the three verses, 12 through 14, you would know there are 10 kings, which will coalesce together only a short while, that they have one policy, that they pool all their resources and their military, and that they will, verse 14, make war with the Lamb. So what's the time setting? At the time of the second coming of Christ. And again, you come up to this either-or statement that either the Bible is true, and either these prophecies are accurate, or they are not. And the Bible isn't true. But if there is a God, and if this is the Word of God, and if the Bible is true, and these prophecies are going to come to pass, then you know this. And I don't care where you look around the world for them, whether you start in Asia and try to come up with China, Japan, and then where do you go from there? Bangladesh? Where do you go from there? Indonesia? China is mostly Buddhist and Confucianist. And Japan is mostly Buddhist, but they have a nationalistic kind of Buddhism, as well as sun worship, but it's called Soka Gakkai. And Indonesia is Islamic. The Philippines, they're mostly Irish, I should say Roman Catholic. Where are you going to find 10 nations whose borders probably are juxtaposed, are together, where 10 nations would coalesce into one gigantic power called a great beast, which is going to fight Christ at his coming? America, Mexico, Canada, and Honduras? Where are you going to look? You've only got one world to search. Where are you going to search? Bolivia, Ecuador? Where are you going to look for 10 nations? And where are you going to look in history for nations that have in the past been warring, bickering, disagreeing nations which have only been brought together at the behest of a great religious leader? It's interesting material. Look at the 17th chapter. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and talked with me, saying, come hither, and I will show you the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of fornication. I won't read all of that because I did it last week. Again, the drunkenness is spiritual drunkenness, and the fornication is simply having concourse as a political arrangement or agreement, as well as economic arrangements and agreements, with a state church instead of really, truly a church as any church ought to be structured. Very few people are aware of the Vatican Bank. Very few people are aware of Marcinkus. Very few people are aware of some of the incredible skullduggery that's been going on over there over all of the post-World War II years. Nor are they aware of some of the sensational books about Pope Pius XII and his absolute refusal to enlist aid in helping get Jews out of Europe prior to the opening of the pogroms of Germany. But there are any number of books on that, and I've read a number of them as well. Now, in coming to the description of that woman, in verse 3, he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast. The papal robes are scarlet. The College of Cardinals wear scarlet. The crown that is worn, the mitre, by these college, the cardinals in the College of Cardinals, from which the popes are elected, is scarlet. Not blood red, but a darker, deeper red that is called scarlet. You're all familiar with the color of scarlet. Well, all right. Scarlet is the color of harlotry or of whoredom. It always has been associated with that. That's why it's called the red light district. That's why way, way back when, a whore would wear a little snip of red, a little ribbon of red in her hair, or otherwise have a little scarlet piece of thread or something on her clothing to identify her trade. I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast. Now, if the woman sits upon the beast, there's probably a saddle there and maybe a bridle. When you sit upon a beast, when a man or a woman sits upon a horse, that means that she is riding, that means she is guiding, or she is controlling the horse. So she is sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy. I urge you once again, I know it's a simple little book. It has a lot of very bland and very, well, I try to please everybody in Halley's Bible Handbook because they're trying to please all the various Protestant churches and so on, but they're sure not trying to please the Catholics. When you look at their article on church history and all of the comments that they make in these chapters in the book of Revelation, it's absolutely amazing. Look at the comments that Halley's Bible Handbook makes with regard to Revelation 17 and 18, for example. I don't know how Mr. Halley even lived a full life without being assassinated with some of the things that he said about the Roman Catholic Church. Having seven heads and ten horns, and the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And you can let your imagination run wild with that, I won't bother. And upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Yesterday I read a letter that came to me. I've been answering a few of them, and there was one man that said that he went to his Catholic priest and asked a question about God the Father and Christ the Son and the Holy Spirit and so on. And his priest said, well, it's a mystery. You don't need to bother trying to explain it, understand it. It's all a mystery. Well, that's what the worldwide church has adopted now. They've adopted the idea that God is a mystery. You can't really understand three in one and one in three and so on. It's an hypostasis. You know, you might wonder, why would people think that someone who lived 200 years this side of Christ, when they still thought that the flies that appeared on dead meat were spontaneously generated from the meat itself, or somebody once saw a watermelon burst in a field and thought the little black seeds had become the little black bugs crawling around it, they never even knew any better until finally somebody put a strip of gauze over a piece of rotting meat and found that the flies were laying eggs which were hatching on the gauze. But why would anybody think that people who still thought the way to cure somebody of a wound was to put a leech on it and let the leech drain blood, that they knew more then, that they could figure out more then about the Bible and the Word of God than we can today? Why would anybody go back and adopt the Nicene Creed and adopt it in order to blend into this world and to go back and begin to celebrate Easter and Christmas and New Year's and so on? Maybe that was the motive at the heart of it all. I don't really know. Mystery. The mother of harlots. Now, who are her daughters? This is a church that has daughters. And those daughters came out of her in protest. If you'll keep your place right there, I want to go to the 47th chapter of Isaiah. Isaiah 47, right quickly, which gives a description of this same woman and some of her boasts and what she says. And it also talks about her daughters. And I think it's fascinating because you know of only one country in all of history which is called the Fatherland. And you know of only one church which is called the Mother Church. You know, Russia is called the Mother Church. Not the motherland is Russia. It's called the Rodina in Russian, means the motherland. Germany is called the fatherland. All nations in history are spoken of as she. They always put that upon them, I guess because of Latin and after that French and so on. They put the gender, like even in the Latin language, like a table or a chair, is feminine in gender, where the ceiling is masculine in gender. Don't ask me why. El techo, la silla. I don't know. But anyway, that's the way they are assigned. So, in chapter 47, verse 1, come down and sit in the dust. In other words, come off of your throne, come away from the pearls, the gold, and the jewels, and just sit in the dirt of the ground, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground, there is no throne anymore, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. All the description here then is, it describes a woman who has been living in fabulous riches, who suddenly is reduced to task work, and even becomes completely naked. Now, in verse 6, I was wroth with my people. I have polluted mine inheritance and given them into thine hand. You did show them no mercy. Upon the ancient have you very heavily laid your yoke. And you said, I shall be a lady forever. So that you did not lay these things to your heart, neither did you remember the latter end of it. Now therefore hear this, you that are given to pleasures, that dwell carelessly, and say in your heart, I am, and none else beside me. And that is a common claim. Of course, there again you hear the words of Christ before Abraham was, I am, and what the member of the divine Elohim said to Moses at the burning bush, I am. So when you look at 2 Thessalonians 2, that this great false prophet is going to sit in the temple of God, claiming that he is God, that may be a statement which will yet be heard in world news. And none else beside me. Do the Catholics acknowledge the Protestants as being valid? No. Do the Catholics acknowledge the Greek Orthodox Church as being really valid? No. They're making overtures toward healing the wound and getting back together. And even the Archbishop of Canterbury has met this current pope. This current pope has had private sessions with the Archbishop or the Great Patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church and has had private meetings with the Archbishop of Canterbury. And for the first time in all of history, it's never happened before in all of history, of course the Jewish state never existed till 1948, but from the time there was a Zionist who said next year in Jerusalem, clear back centuries and centuries ago, there has never been the remote suggestion that a Jew, some kind of a Jewish state or a Jewish entity or a Jewish foundation or a Jewish trust fund or a Jewish organization, whatever it would be, the Zionist organization or any of them like the Irgun or the Palmach or the Haganah, would send a representative to the Vatican. But now today, there is, under the aegis of the Israeli government, an actual ambassador at the same level as the ambassador to the United States, the ambassador to the United Kingdom, the ambassador to Germany. And there are Israeli ambassadors all over the world. There's also an Israeli ambassador to the Vatican. And there's a Vatican ambassador in Jerusalem to Israel. Brand new. Only about 3.5 years old. I am. No, they do not acknowledge that they're second best. They don't acknowledge that there's anybody else. They are the one and the only true church, they say. Now, you know, if anybody else says that, you're in deep trouble. Oh, do people get on your case? What do you mean you're the one and the only? Oh, they get incensed. But the Catholics say it all the time. It's in every bit of their literature and every one of their pronunciations. It's exactly their very, you know, foremost statement that they are the one universal church, the one true church, the church Jesus built, the one church of which Peter was the first pope, and every one of the popes are supposed to be St. Peter's successors. None else beside me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon you in their perfection for the multitude of your sorceries and for the great abundance of your enchantments. I won't read it all, but that evil is going to come upon them, and we can read about that back in the 18th chapter of the book and the last few verses, really, of the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. Let's turn back to Revelation 17. While you're turning there, let me remind you that all emperors, commencing with Charlemagne, all the way down to very recent times, were crowned by the Pope. The Pope himself wears a papal crown. I have seen many of the crowns, including the one that is worn currently by the current popes today in the Vatican Museum. And contrary to what the Seventh-day Adventists say, there is no statement on it that adds up to 666. They would like that to be so. I've seen the crowns. I stared at them. I tried any way I could to find into letters or numerals or numbers that would come out that way. It's just not there. It'd be nice if it were, but it's not. So I'm not going to repeat that fable. That is not necessary to identify who these people are or the historical or prophetical significance. The Pope wears a crown. What is a crown? It's called a diadem, isn't it? And it's a symbol of what? Well, of absolute authority, the symbol of a king. Why would a religious leader wear a crown? Are church leaders supposed to wear a crown? Here's a quotation I just copied out of the Catholic Encyclopedia that I read extensively this morning. Quote, Charlemagne was solemnly crowned at St. Peter's in Rome by Pope Leo III on Christmas Day 800. And you can see the significance of that. They probably made very much to do over the fact that that was the finish of the first 700 years, and they were beginning the seventh 700 cycle, and that Pope Leo III, who was also the one responsible for claiming that when a pope spoke ex cathedra, he was absolutely infallible. There were others who followed on with that later. I continue the quote. He, that is Charlemagne, was met in state outside the walls and escorted to St. Peter's. Next came the reception by the Pope, who sat enthroned and surrounded by his cardinals at the head of the steps before St. Peter's. And there the Emperor, after kissing the Pope's foot, took the coronation oath. Quote, in the name of Christ, I, the Emperor, promise, undertake, and protest in the presence of God and blessed Peter the Apostle that I will be the protector and defender of the Holy Roman Church in all ways that I can be of help, in omnibus utilitabibus, so far as I shall be supported by the divine aid, according to my knowledge and ability. This undertaking, which was at first clearly not an oath in form, they go on to say, was afterwards strengthened by a number of added clauses. For instance, the words, quote, I swear upon the holy gospels, end quote, or again by an explicit promise of fealty to the reigning pope by name and to his successors. One of the most famous paintings of all of history is in the Louvre, which I have seen on a number of occasions. It is huge. It is almost as big as, well, it's bigger than that wall, I guess. And all the figures are almost life-size, and there are dozens of them. And it's a picture of the interior of Notre Dame in Paris. And there is the Pope, and there are the College of Cardinals, and there are all the dignitaries and people with their spears and their shepherd's crook standing around. And here is Napoleon, and there is Josephine. And the look on the Pope's face is interesting, because Napoleon is in the process of snatching the crown out of the Pope's hands and jamming it on his own head. And then he took the crown and he jammed it on Josephine's head. He wanted to show the Pope who was really in charge. But they were in the process of Napoleon being coronated by the Pope. It's a very famous painting. There is a woodcut replica of it in the Catholic Encyclopedia that I just saw again this morning, but I've seen the original, and it is great art, a great moment in history, I suppose, in one way. But nevertheless, it is illustrative of what I'm talking about. Now, coming back to the statement that was made that I want to find and repeat for you again, that was on the very first page of the news items that I read to you. Mr. Fischer, the defense minister for Germany, said, and I quote, Europeans will never become a homogeneous nation state because of differences in language, history, prejudices, passions, and animosities. Now, in Revelation, the 17th chapter, and in verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now, a day is a year being fulfilled, and an hour is a 24th part of a year, or if you take just the daylight part, a 12th. Does that mean 2 weeks? Somebody could extrapolate from that and claim it means only 2 weeks. I would assume longer than that. Does it mean 1 month? I would assume longer than 1 month. I don't know for sure. All we know for sure is it is a short time. We have no other precedent for it anywhere in the Bible where we do have in Numbers 14, 34, I think, and a couple of others like Ezekiel 4:8. We've got the year for the day, not just a theory, but the definite clue from God's word that as the spies searched out 40 days, so 40 years would be the time that they would dwell in the land or the wilderness. All right, they shall have one policy, give their power and strength unto the beast, and they have one mind, and they receive all of that power as kings 1 hour with the beast. Now, verse 15, and remember the image that we saw in Daniel 2. The waters which you saw where the whore sitteth are peoples, that's different peoples, different races, and multitudes, gigantic populations, and nations, and tongues. Sometimes nations, which are political entities, involve far more than one ethnic entity, don't they? It's commonplace and it's caused an awful lot of problems, just like in Canada, where the separatist movement is still alive and well up in Ottawa. And just like the Moluccans that, of course, rioted and wanted a separate state for themselves, well, they really didn't want that so much as they wanted redress of grievances because of the Flemish people in Belgium. And Belgium is made up of Flemish as well as the Moluccans and some other people that are there. And, of course, the velvet divorce between the Czech Republic and Slovakia, which is very, very recent, only a few years old. Czechoslovakia was created after World War I, and as a matter of fact, and those peoples don't get along either. And the Sudetenland, which is just like a horseshoe on the western part of old Czechoslovakia, had 3 million ethnic Germans and German-speaking. Whenever you have that, when a Hitler comes to power, and then you've got ethnic Germans in a nearby state who are the majority, if there isn't already animosity, you're going to have your agents create one so you can have a pretext to invade the country. So the white paper that Chamberlain came back waving in 1938 or 9, whatever it was, 38 I think, and said, it's peace in our time, was when they gave the Sudetenland with its 3 million ethnic Germans to Hitler at Hitler's demand. That's all I want. And then I don't want any more. Well, of course, that was nonsense, but just to illustrate that point. Now, verse 16, the 10 horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked. What do we read in Isaiah 47? I shall not know the loss of children. I will never know widowhood. I shall always sit as a queen. Come and get thou into the dust, O harlot daughter of Babylon. There is no more throne. And eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill His will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. Why the hatred? Well, because things haven't gone so well. Because what they were promised didn't materialize. Because of what they will assume is betrayal. Because this describes a great war. What is the time setting here? The only thing you can conclude here is that God allows this to occur at or just after the time of the second coming of Christ. I've told you before that there is a 3.5-year ministry the other side of the second coming of Christ before the millennial reign of Christ really begins. And that includes the regathering of Israel from all over the world. That includes the prophecies in the book of Obadiah. That includes the prophecies in the last few verses of Isaiah, the 11th chapter, about how never more will reference to the former Exodus be made, but now it will be said the Israelites who came from the north country will completely supplant any memory in any Jewish mind for all the generations to come of the Exodus from Egypt, but now the greater captivity of a far greater number of them in far more nations all over the world. And that will become a statement that will be heard often through the time of the millennium. And the woman which you saw is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Now, let me tell you something about the nations in Europe. France, what do you think the percentage is of religion in France, Roman Catholicism to Protestantism? 90%. This is from the Almanac. This is accurate. 90% Roman Catholic. Belgium, 75% Roman Catholic. Germany, 30% Roman Catholic. Bavaria, almost 100%, and 45% mostly Lutheran. If you know the Lutheran Church, if you know their liturgy, if you know their form of services, if you know that they repeat the Apostles' Creed, if you know how close they are to Roman Catholicism, it is only that they don't acknowledge the Pope, and otherwise they would, for all the world, look like a Roman Catholic Church. Of course, Luther was the one who protested mostly about indulgences and all of the problems because of the incredible financial ripoff of many of the priests and the incredible licentiousness of that day. Austria, 85% Roman Catholic. Poland, 95% Roman Catholic, and the current Pope is a Pole. Hungary, 68% Roman Catholic, 20% Calvinist Protestant, and 5% Lutheran. Bulgaria, 85% Bulgarian Orthodox, which is almost the identical thing of Greek Orthodox, but just with a nationalistic flavor, and it's very close to Catholicism, except they worship before icons instead of statues. They also have 13% Muslim in that country. Romania, Romanian Orthodoxy, 89%. Croatia, 77% Roman Catholic and 11% Orthodox. The Czech Republic, divided about evenly between atheism, 39% to 40%, and Roman Catholicism, 39% to 40%. Greece, 98% Greek Orthodox. What will be the miry clay? What will be the glue that will bind together otherwise disparate, oftentimes down through history, bickering, arguing, even warring nations, which will bring them together for a short time? But one powerful, charismatic, spiritual figure who will actually claim to have the powers of God, and who for a brief period of time will be able to prove it to them by miracles which they cannot gainsay. 2 Thessalonians 2. Calling down fire, having a second Pentecost in front of a gigantic meeting of the heads of state of all of Europe? Could a man do that? Could he stand there and say, if I be a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and demonic powers bring it to pass? The prophecies strongly indicate that Europe will be brought together eventually by a powerful, charismatic, religious leader. But because they will be utterly decimated and destroyed at the time of the second coming of Christ as a result directly of doing what they're going to do to the Jewish state and to Britain and to our beloved United States of America, then God is going to cause the second coming of Jesus Christ to take care of them. They are going to lose that great war and hate the whore that got them into it and turn upon the College of Cardinals and every surviving priest and nun and every Catholic they can find, and there's going to be a bloodbath like you've never seen before, and it's described right here in the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation. After these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen. But Babylon had fallen in 546, 539, actually, B.C., and this was written in 92 A.D., and so he's not talking about ancient Babylon, the city-state along the Tigris-Euphrates River. He's talking about modern-day mystery, Babylon the great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And has become the habitation of demons, the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Who do you think is going to possess the mind of an individual who would call himself God and have the power to call down fire from heaven? Satan the devil. Who possessed Judas Iscariot at the night of the Last Supper when Jesus said, that which thou doest, do quickly? Satan. Once Satan had worked his will through Judas, what did the devil do to Judas? He left him. What did Judas do? He began to come to himself and realize what he had done. And the guilt came pouring over him and into his mind, and he went out and hung himself. First he took the money. It's blood money. I've got to get rid of it. He took it back and he said, here, take it. They said, you see to that. We don't want anything to do with that. He threw it down in front of them and left and went out and hung himself. What's going to happen when those individuals, especially the Pope himself, who is going to be possessed by Satan the devil, and the devil leaves him, then what is he going to do? Interesting thoughts, aren't they? When you look at biblical prophecy and you understand how these things are going to shape up in world affairs, you know what to watch for, what to look for, what events, what developments here and there. And when we live in a world where you have the most traveled, the most charismatic, most beloved Pope in the history of all of the world ensconced in the Vatican today, and I'm not saying he is the last Pope which is going to do all of this. I know that he's very elderly and he's getting senile. I know he's been shot. I know that he's had a lot of sickness and so on. I don't know that he'll be the last one. There have only been five Sixtuses. Maybe there will be a Sixtus the sixth. Who knows? But in any event, these are going to happen. That's why he says, all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, as we read back in verse 2 and 3 of chapter 17. And the kings of the earth, which have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth, are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues, and practically everything that Protestantism has, including Christmas, Easter, Halloween, etc., and a great deal of their religion, comes directly from Roman Catholicism, not the least of which the idea of the immortality of the soul. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her double according to her works. In the cup which she has filled, filled to her double. How much she has glorified herself and lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her. For she saith in her heart, where do we read this? I sit a queen and am no widow and shall see no sorrow. So the mother church and the fatherland will come together, and the woman will mount the beast and control it for a short period of time, and the glue or the miry clay, which will appear to put it all together, no matter how disparate and bickering and disagreeing and warring they might have been in the past, will be the Roman Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic religion. I remember that limerick, and I've written about it before. There was a young lady from Niger who smiled as she rode on the tiger. They returned from the ride with the lady inside and the smile on the face of the tiger. And that reminds me of what's going to happen to the old whore who sits astride the beast for the ride that is going to be a very short duration. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. I won't read all the rest of that chapter because it is quite lengthy. But I think an awful lot begins to come clear when you allow your mind to look at current events in the light of biblical prophecy and to ask yourself, how do these things come to pass? It isn't by divine fiat. It is by easily discernible human events, the machinations and the politics of different governments, and sometimes the betrayals and the secret pacts and agreements and all this type of thing that is going on. I wish I could have read all of Gerhard Schroeder's speech to you, because he also makes overtures toward Russia. And there's a great deal in what he said. But I have an article coming along in the next issue of World Watch, which is going to go into a lot of these things as well, which you will be reading very, very shortly. As Jesus Christ said, watch you therefore, and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things and to stand before the Son of Man. I have never said watch world news exclusively and pay no attention to our own spiritual development, have I? But I've been accused of it. And there are people who are trying to use that to disparagingly speak about headline religion. Well, I wonder if the headlines that I have been reading are important. And I wonder if the headlines that are going to be read in the next year or two or three, as we look at Y2K and the launch of the euro and the German presidency of the EU and the German foreign minister pushing for a united Europe, are going to be important to those people who have heard me warning them about this for about the past 42 years.